People Against Pierce. Council are present and may set up.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, it's Carolyn Blanchard appearing for Mr. Pierce. My goal in this argument is to attempt to convince you that Mr. Pierce's 35 counts should be reduced to about, I think I counted seven, that there should be one count of aggravated incest, one count of sexual assault on a child in position of trust, and one count of sexual assault on a child, and no pattern counts because there's no predicate pattern.
You are setting aside here for a moment your argument about the error in the court's decision to not to excuse jurors for cause.
Well, I will. I just was briefly going to mention that I'm still presenting that to the court, but it's just a limited argument.
I see what you're saying, but that argument, if valid, would affect the propriety of all the counts.
Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly would. The basic issue here is the corpus selecti issue. Is so. What this young woman said was that essentially there was one incident of sexual assault with her father, stepfather, in the home. And this was the bedroom to the shower incident. And under Woolf, this is one incident. And it was extended by the prosecution to make many acts and extended into the many counts that were charged in this case. The young woman was consistent in her statements to the police and as well as to the jury that her father in the home had this one incident of sexual contact. This young woman, not like many of the women we hear in trials, that he was touching me all the time and every time I walked by something occurred, she only said, other than the times when she said, no, don't leave me alone, no, leave me alone, and there was no sexual contact. There was just the one contact when he took her to the bedroom and then to the bathroom, and this was all one incident. And that's how the first officer that got her first comments described it consistently in his testimony.
Ms. Blanchard, I do have a question. I think there was evidence in the record about something happening in a den. And when he was seated in a chair and she was on his lap and he called her back to his lap, was that presented as an incident of sexual assault or what was that?
No. That was, she described, I believe, as the last incident. And I believe that's the incident that she decided that she needed to tell her friends about. But that was never charged as one of the assaults.
How can you tell?
That's a good question.
I mean, there are counts here that have to do with touching of the breast over the clothing with his hand and touching of the breast under the clothing with his hand. Couldn't those counts be associated with the den incident?
But she never said that. And this young woman was able to say what happened to her. And, you know, she used adult big words.
Graphic terms, yes. She was able to describe these incidents, right?
Right.
But I'm wondering about this one particularly, whether her statements, which admittedly fall short of alleging that the defendant touched her breasts, combined with the gestures that are recorded on that videotaped interview would give rise to a fair inference that, in fact, the defendant did touch her breasts on that occasion.
Well, I must say my recall of the videotape is minimal because I looked at it a long time ago. But what she testified at trial was that he touched her clasp at the center of her breasts, the clasp of her bra, and not her breasts. So that's, you know, technical, I'll admit, but if he didn't touch her breasts, he didn't touch them. We can't say touching a bra is touching the breast, because, I mean, touch the back of her bra, and that's not touching her breast.
Absolutely. But here we're looking now not for evidence that would necessarily support all the elements of that charge, but rather for mere corroboration of the defendant's confession as to this incident. So in other words, wouldn't...
Well, you have a point there. He did say in his statement to the police that he touched her breasts in the home. But still, it's so minimal corroboration because this young woman knew what to say. She could have said, he touched my breast, while he was touching my bra, you know, but she certainly didn't say that.
And I certainly agree that given the nature of the victim's reporting here, that she was capable of describing sexual contact graphically.
In detail.
Yeah.
And precisely. So most of the cases used to support the corroboration, I mean, they're robberies. I mean, there's something was taken. There's drugs. There's something was there. But we have no injury to this young woman, so there's no physical evidence of any sexual assault to corroborate my client's statement.
Counsel, just quickly, assuming you're correct, that we agree with you on this point, then this is going to result in the vacation of many counts.
Certainly.
Here, and yield a conviction of, I presume, 6 counts, which in your view will then merge to essentially 1 count each of aggravated incest, sex assault on the child by one in a position of trust, and sexual assault on the child. But this will affect the defendant's sentence how?
Well, the most grievous offense would be the pattern, and because there is no preceding or succeeding incident, then the pattern is gone, and I believe it drops him down to level 4 at 4.
So it would require resentencing then?
Certainly.
Okay, thank you.
And as to the juror issue, these 3 jurors say they try to be fair, and I think our law requires that jurors be fair, that they're able to say, we will be fair, not just try to be fair. I know the case law supports that, but I don't think it's right. I think due process, fair trial, we need fair jurors. And we need them to be able to say, I will be fair, not just I'll try to be fair.
Ms. Blanchard, given that there are a line of cases that saying, well, try to be fair is sufficient to show that there was no error in the denial of the challenge for cause, how was this case different from those cases?
Well, I don't know exactly the facts of the other cases. I can't argue that. But I think in these sexual offense cases with children, when I believe there were 3 women that said, I really believe these children, and, you know, I'm really soft on kids, or something to that effect. I believe each of these jurors said that that's that's kind of different from taking a purse or taking a car. It's something more to the heart or emotional and difficult to separate oneself from. I think it's, you can look at someone and say, well, yeah, they took the purse, big deal, you know. Well, probably most of us have had something stolen from us, and we can separate that. But it's, but even, you know, as people say, when people come into their homes, you know, that's a physical effect. But I'll leave it with that, that I think it's, especially in a sexual assault case, dealing with children and the emotional involvement, that trying to be fair isn't sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 5 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Majid Yazdi, registration 36043, representing the people in this case. The main question, which is the first question addressed in the briefs before this court, is whether the evidence presented was sufficient to deny a judgment for judgment of acquittal, which requires establishing prima facie case to go for the case before the jury. The concept of corpus delicti essentially addresses whether extrajudicial statements, confessions, admissions by the defendant alone are sufficient to meet the prima facie case, prima facie evidence standard. And the cases almost universally acknowledge that the essence of that concept is whether those admissions are reliable and trustworthy. As long as the overall evidence presented, which means including corroborating evidence, establishes the trustworthiness and the reliability of those statements, then there is no problem of corpus delicti having not been established. And there are three aspects to the corroborating evidence that emerge from the discussions in the cases. One is that this corroborating evidence can be circumstantial. It doesn't have to be direct evidence. And I can point out the case of Hodges, which I discussed in the brief, clearly points out where the defendant made out-of-court statement that the drugs were imported from California, but at trial, during his testimony, denied that they were imported from California. However, acknowledging that he was in California. And the court ruled that the acknowledgement that he was in California was sufficient corroborating evidence that the out-of-court statements were trustworthy and reliable to be to be relied on for the purpose of corpus delicti. The second aspect of the corroborating evidence is that it all that is needed is a slight evidence. What Ms. Blanchard pointed out, minimal, that is enough. We don't have to have sufficient evidence to convict the defendant. As long as there is corroboration of the statements made by the defendant himself, that slight evidence, and U.S. Supreme Court of Upper, which again I cite in brief, makes that statement that slight evidence need not be sufficient. And finally, that evidence need not be independent. We look at the total circumstances of the case, the circumstances of the statements that the defendant made, and overall consider whether there is sufficient corroboration of those statements or not. What we have here as corroborating evidence is victims' statements plus defendant's own statements to the victim during the pretext phone call. And as I have argued in the brief, this statement is different from the confessions made at the police station, because all the concerns that are raised regarding confessions alone being used as evidence is that somehow it may be imaginary, may not be real, because the defendant presumably is under pressure because of police investigation. Indirect coercion may result in confessions that are not real, but imaginary. But in the pretext phone call, this is before the defendant was even charged, and it is a conversation, casual conversation with the victim. There are no pressures to question the validity of those statements, reliability and trustworthiness of those statements. The case of U.S. Supreme Court case of Smith, again cited both by Ms. Blanchard and myself in the briefs, suggests that those factors are the ones that courts are concerned with when they address the question of corpus delicti.
Mr. Yazzie, did you, I'm sure you probably did look for this authority, were you able to find authority for the proposition that this type of extrajudicial statement is not implicated in the corpus delicti rule, and in fact sort of counts as perhaps corroborating evidence itself?
I have looked, as far as I remember, Your Honor, there was no case specifically on that point. However, as I pointed out from Smith case, for example, the issues that are raised there is that people under pressure from police investigation may be, you know, inclined to make statements that are inculpatory. So by inference from those cases, we can generalize that the concerns, the type of concern that exists under those circumstances do not exist when there's casual conversation over the phone. So, and I'd like to point out, as defense counsel argued in the closing argument, this case actually represents a case that false confession, to quote defense counsel, is a hard pill to swallow. Because, again, the circumstances of that confession, the pretext phone call, and even the manner of the statements made, which is obvious on the videotape, police videotape, show that the defendant was not under any kind of pressure. And that is why to argue that it was a false confession, which is, you know, the essence of corpus delicti, that doesn't exist here. It is an admission by defense counsel that we are not dealing with false confession here.
Well, Mr. Yazdi, let me ask you this. I understand the corpus delicti rule applies to confessions to police. And what I understand you saying right now is, well, in this confession, there was no indication of coercion. So is there any authority to say non-coerced confessions to police wouldn't fall under the corpus delicti rule?
I'm not suggesting that corpus delicti limits to coercion, because that would be covered by exclusionary rules. Again, the Smith case recognizes that corpus delicti covers more than that, because there could be, again, just police investigation without any direct coercion that may lead to that kind. So, no, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that it is limited to coercion directly. On the question of challenges for cause, we stand by the arguments made in the brief, and unless the court has any questions, I ask the court to affirm defendant's judgment.
Actually, I do have a question, counsel. It's sort of a complicated one. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we disagree with you about your threshold observation here, and that we conclude that these extrajudicial statements that trigger the same underlying concerns that are present in any confession situation, so that any extrajudicial confession, whether a defendant is bragging to his friends or is, you know, feeling guilt-ridden and confesses in a pretext phone call or confessing to the police, that all of this counts as a confession that would implicate the corpus delicti rule. If we start with that proposition, then we do have an interesting problem to deal with here, because we have several counts that seem to rest entirely on the defendant's confession. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in sorting out whether we have corroboration,
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Now, in trying to sort out whether we have corroboration on those points, we have this statement from the victim that at least on one occasion, the incident that is now referred to as the sort of upstairs from the bedroom to the bathroom incident, that the defendant's hands were all over her. And so in some way, that could corroborate many types of touching. And yet it's pretty clear from the context that she's referring to just those that day, the events of that day. So do we take up first the multiplicity analysis and decide whether we're talking about one day, one incident, or many, or do we take up the corroboration first and decide that we do or don't have corroboration of these individual touchings? Do you have an opinion about how we approach this analytically?
I believe, Your Honor, the corroboration issue, if it is determined that for on the question of the corpus delicti principle, if for whatever reason the court concludes that we have not met the burden of showing that there was no problem with that, that becomes the initial step in the inquiry, because that raises a question of the judgment, motion for judgment of acquittal, whether it should be granted or not. So it seems to me that would be the first issue. But again, I'd like to point out that Ms. Blanchard's argument that we have to limit ourselves only to the specific statements made by the defendant, that is not correct, because we look at, again, corroboration of the statements made by the defendant, and that is only part of it. And this defendant, although was mature enough to describe certain circumstances, we shouldn't expect defendants that young to be, you know, specific with respect to every incident. Here we have the defendant acknowledging during both conversations repeatedly the nature of the relationship that he had, both in the truck and at home, and acknowledging to that. So all we need is corroboration for those statements. We don't have to establish every act underlying every count based only on the statements made by the defendant.
Could I ask you one more hypothetical question then? Let's assume we have a victim's statements that would fully corroborate events 1 and 2, and we have confessions from the defendant as to 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. Would you say that the corroboration as to the first two events provides the necessary security and reliability to support an inference that the confessions as to events 3 and 4 were not merely fabricated?
As a general principle, Your Honor, I would suggest that is exactly the...
That seems to be the active ingredient underlying your argument here. Thank you.
Mr. Yazdi, let me follow up on that a little bit. So if in incidents 3 and 4, you have a description by the victim as to what happened, and that description does not identify criminal conduct, would the result be any different?
That makes a case a little bit more difficult. Again, it goes to the essence of whether there is sufficient corroboration to make the statements trustworthy. So it creates more challenge to establish that. But I think, again, as a matter of principle, that might be enough in some cases. Because, again, we go into the overall relationship between the defendant and the victim, and once we put everything together, it provides sufficient evidence for that. So maybe, you know, we are talking about, for example, kissing at some point, not specifically mentioning the sexual contact that can be used, but I think that, along with other statements, show that the statements made by the defendant were reliable. Because the nature of the relationship suggests that that could have happened. And then we leave it up to the jury, because at this point we are just talking about prima facie evidence to be established. And the challenge is not that there was insufficient evidence to convict, but that it was insufficient to go to the jury.
I think just following up with that and in trying to resolve this issue, I guess what I'm grappling with is take it out of a corpus delicti context. And if you have one person saying this type of touching did occur and the other person said this type of touching did not occur, usually we refer to that as inconsistent evidence. But right now in the corpus delicti, we're talking about this, is this corroborating evidence? And so can you help resolve the different way we look at these things?
Again, I think when we take all the factors into consideration, we have an adult, an individual with much more experience than a young woman. She may have not fully realized what had happened, whereas the person who is admitting to what happened, we have to trust that statement, unless there are other reasons to say that he is imagining for some mental condition reason, for example. So when you put it that way, between two statements being inconsistent, definitely the statement made by the defendant would be more trustworthy and reliable, given that he was the one who perpetrated the act and he was fully aware of what he was doing, whereas the victim may not realize. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I did find one supplemental authority, which I'll submit to the court. It's a case out of the Ninth Circuit, Arizona. Do you want me to give you the site now, or do you just want me to submit it later?
Ms. Blanchard, why don't you submit that in written form?
Fine.
And then, Mr. Yazdi, if you would respond to that within a week after her written submission is filed, we'd appreciate that.
Thank you. And the Hodges case, that was the drug case, the one with the California statement. So the man was caught with drugs. There's something graphic and real there. In our case, all we have graphic and real are the statements of the complainant. The pretext phone call, I described this young woman's conversation with her stepfather as badgering. Didn't you do this? Didn't you do that? Didn't you? And it was prompted by the police.
Counsel, how would you respond to your colleague's suggestion here that under the principles identified in Smith, it doesn't make any difference because this was not a custodial interrogation with police, and that the concerns underlying the corpus delicti rule really have to do with police interrogations, police confessions?
Well, that's primarily it, but I think the corroboration, it could be corroborated, but it can't be corroborated in this case because he never said he did these things in the home in the pretext call. He just said he did these things. So this is information that the judge told the jury you couldn't use because it's not proof it was done in the home. So that's the problem with the pretext call. And it just wasn't a casual conversation. I certainly object to that characteristic of that conversation. And the very last discussion you were having with the prosecution in this case, he's more or less shifting the burden of proof here to the defendant. Is he imagining things or is he not? I mean, he's saying he has to prove he's got a mental problem or some kind of. He's a screwball in some way. I mean, and that's definitely shifting the burden of proof. So if the man, you know, was just hallucinating about what he did or didn't do or exaggerating or, it's another word in my brief, which I like, but I can't think of it. You know, we can't prosecute people for their thoughts. That's not what we do. And I guess that's all I'd like to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Court thanks both counsel for their arguments, and this case will be deemed submitted, and the written opinion will issue in due course.